Today, New York Times columnist Charles Blow. Charles Blow has led a rather unique life, starting in one of America's extremes and ending up in another. Thanks for being on the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So you've written a memoir of your life, or life up to a certain point. Heavily concentrated on the earlier years.
Yes.
It's called Fire Shut Up in My Bones, and right. that's a biblical quote.
Yes, it is.
Tell me about that.
Oh, that's Jeremiah. If you read Jeremiah, Jeremiah's complaining a lot. And so Jeremiah's complaining again about having to preach and not getting a warm reception and feeling like he just doesn't want to do it anymore. But he says he can't hold it in. He says, when I try to hold it in, it feels like a fire shut up in my bones. And I always thought that was just a beautiful metaphor for kind of irrepressible truth and a need to say something. And it seemed completely appropriate for this book.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Let's start where the book starts, because okay. That's where you chose to start it, and not quite where you end it. The book starts with a pretty unique scene. Not the typical image of a New York Times columnist. Describe.
Whatever do you mean? No, the book opens with a scene when I am 20 years old.
I am a grambling.
I'm a college student, and I am, in a rage and racing down Interstate 20 with a gun, going to, in my mind at the moment, thinking that I'm about to shoot and kill someone. And that person is the person who, when I was 7 years old, was, my childhood sexual abuser, who is an older cousin. And I hadn't spoken to him or seen him in years. And, it's one of these kind of uncontrollable, unexplainable reactions to unresolved trauma, I believe.
And that incident had haunted you forever many ways.
Right. I think the incident also... The bullying, I think even the bullying is probably even more significant than the actual incident. I think that our bodies are able to rebound to some degree. It's the psychic damage that is much more difficult to rebound from. And the bullying by him to keep me from telling us, which I assume that was the reason for it.
Right, calling you punk, which
that part was the part that was, I think, more damaging to me, because the actual incident of abuse that happened only once. It wasn't like a repeated thing. It wasn't even as invasive as some other things that I've read and I've heard people say about what abuse is like to them, which is incredibly physically violent. And that wasn't the case here. So I always assumed that I could have probably bounced back from that. I could not, however, escape the bullying, because that didn't just happen at, a few minutes in the middle of a summer night. That came into the daylight. There was nowhere to hide from it.
And it happened in front of your four brothers.
Yes, it happened all the time. And so that part was, I think, what became the most damaging, the thing that carried the most
weight. That was the fire that was shut up in your bones.
In a way. In a way, yeah.
And in the car, you were on your way to exercise that demon?
Right. I'm going to talk about it as if it's logical, and of course it isn't. It's not something that makes sense to want to take another person's life. But yes, in that moment, that was the thinking was, if there was thinking, I'm not even sure that it was completely cogent, but believing that in that moment that if I could remove him from the world, then the world would be better for me.
And, eventually you have an epiphany that you describe in the book as he didn't deserve to die for what he had done, and I deserve to live in spite of it.
Right, right. And all of this is happening quite literally in the span of about 4 or 5 minutes. I mean, from the moment that I jump in a car and the moment that I say, Charles, you have to stop this. You cannot continue to live your life through the eyes of a seven-year-old boy. This is all, it's 5 minutes, but it stretches over a number of pages because it is the kind of crucial moment, I believe, for me.
Crucial moment because it's what allowed you to free yourself from your past?
Right. I think, yes, absolutely. And I think that is one of the things that we don't always realize that we have the power to do, that we don't always understand that freedom is in us. That we have the ability to free ourselves. We we spend our entire lives looking for freedom as if it is something we chase to the ends of the earth. And in fact, it is within you. And I had to realize that in that moment.
Freedom is a very American word, and your journey is a uniquely American journey in the sense that you, I mean, you know, your childhood was in small Louisiana town, living a segregated life. And I mean, it's sort of the way you write about it, I kept sort of thinking, is this the 1930s? I mean, is this Ray Charles's childhood? Is this, you know, Muddy Waters? I mean, it's a kind of America. And I suppose we're talking about the 70s.
Yes, we are. And 80s.
It seems much further away, but it's not. And now you are a New York Times columnist, the greatest job in journalism. And that's a hell of a journey. That's a very unique American journey.
Yes. I don't know what to say to that.
Well, I don't think it was a question. It was an observation. So talk about that childhood and where you grew up and how you grew up and your mom and your dad and what that life was like.
Well, that's going to take the rest of our time. So
you got a minute. No.
You said some of it. So it was a small town when I was born, probably about 1,000 people. It was segregated, not legislated into segregation, but kind of people self-segregated. And even the schools were segregated. And that was because Louisiana had dragged its feet forever, complying with Brown v. Board of Education. And in fact, our local school district didn't comply until the year I was born, which is 1970. And it does exist apart from, I think, what people think of as the 70s and 80s. And I think that part of that is that small town America exists apart from what we in big cities think of as what is modern and what is happening in the moment. And their moments are very different. I mean, time doesn't work the same way in small town America. And, you know, you have families that have lived in the same places forever, and everybody knows everyone else, and everyone helps everyone else. And particularly before the advent of the internet, where you could have access to other ideas. I mean, nothing really got in. You got a little bit from television, but it was as if you were watching, you know, someone from another country when you saw people living in big cities, because you know, I couldn't even understand. Like, what do you mean? Right. There's a highway, there's houses stacked on top of each other. Like, there's a high rise. I don't understand what this is. So it was very kind of untouched in that way. But it was also a very poor town, and you know, every person I knew seemed to be some gradation of poverty, including our family. And so it made it tough. And one of the things that I'm very happy that the book covers is that it really, I think, paints a picture of the other poverty in America. It is the rural poverty, which we don't always talk about. We talk about it,
Appalachia,
yes,
as this sort,
yes,
of,
yes,
concept.
Like, exactly. But this, you know, these people work really hard, and they just can't make enough, and that creates its own stressors. And
is it strange for you to go back to that world? I mean, you know, you live about as far away from it as you can.
It feels very normal to me.
What about when that world comes to visit you in Brooklyn? I mean, your mom or brothers, or
they don't quite get it. New York. And my mom visits more than my brothers, and you know, she just stays home with the kids, and she doesn't really like to go out. Maybe she'll go out to, like, you know, shop a little bit, but it doesn't feel like a culture clash to me. And so it's odd, because I always think of that New York and my hometown have a lot in common, strangely enough, that New York always feels like a collection of really small towns. So, you know, my block, I go to the same grocery store, the same dry cleaners, the same coffee shop. Everyone knows you. You don't have, you know, you forgot your wallet. Oh, don't worry about it. Come back and pay me tomorrow. That's how my small town worked.
Right.
And the idea of kind of communal spaces, my house felt like a cafe, because there were people constantly coming and going and eating and talking and laughing. And so it feels like home to me. What scares me is like suburban America, because I don't get that. Like
any street name Chantilly or something. I'm talking with New York Times columnist Charles M. Blow about his new memoir, Fire Shut Up in My Bones. Initially, you were kind of considered a slow kid until they did some IQ tests.
Right. Yes. Well, during a period of, I guess that's probably like second, third grade. And I think that was in part because of all the stress.
Right.
On top of the poverty, it was my mom. I was going to school with my mom where she worked, which was another school 30 minutes away. And it was, you know, the stress of traveling back and forth, my parents breaking up, and the dissolution of the family, the childhood sexual abuse had happened the year before. It was way too much for a kid of my age to deal with. And I just didn't have the language and the agency for myself to even explain to people what was happening. And so I just simply started to retreat. And I think that often happens. And we, you know, the teachers were going to warehouse me with the slow kids. And I think we do that far too much instead of looking for what the source of the issues are with children.
Right.
And understanding that stress plays an incredible role in a child's life and their ability to learn, their ability to engage. I couldn't think about school because everything else was so heavy on my mind. And, you know, the warehousing begins and we say, you know, there's something wrong with this kid. Well, there probably is, but it's not necessarily that they're slow. It's just that they have, they're carrying the weight of the
and
world.
And so a standardized test, an IQ test, sort of allows the school to understand who you really are, and you thrive, you succeed, you have valedictorian. But you tell a great story about going to a science fair,
right.
Your first airplane trip to I'm not sure where you were flying out of, but going to Knoxville,
yes.
Tennessee.
Yes, the year I win my way to the International Science Fair, it would be in Knoxville, Tennessee,
right,
instead of Brazil or somewhere.
Sao Paulo, ay caramba. And you know, you go there, and you know, you're the biggest deal. You're on the basketball team. You're valedictorian. You know, you're a big deal back home. But you learn pretty quickly you're not such a big deal when you're competing, when you're up against those other kids.
Oh no, I mean, and I had done this project on the Star Wars program, which was big when I was a kid. You know, the Reagan administration and
missile defense.
They were going to shoot down the missiles before they got here, and we no longer had to crouch under our desks and do you know, the drills,
duck
or whatever.
And cover,
And I did this project about why it wouldn't work. Only I didn't do. I violated the cardinal rule of science project, which is I didn't actually do an experiment. It was like a research project. But because at the district level, which is how you get to the International Science Fair, you get the military judges are a big part of the judging process. And they were fascinated by this idea.
Ah.
And so I win the district fair and I go to the International Science Fair and I'm walking around like, and there's a kid who has also done a project on why the missile defense system wouldn't work, but he's a Westinghouse science program winner for his, and it's like it's mathematical as to why it wasn't working. And this looks like Egyptian hieroglyphics to me. I have no clue what this kid is doing, and I realize in that moment, like, you might be, like you said, you might be hot stuff in your little town of 1,000 people, but this is the real competition. The world is really tough. And they're not going to cut you any slack. And you're going to have to be smarter. And you're going to have to be tougher.
Tomorrow, we'll continue my conversation with Charles M. Blow about his memoir, Fire Shut Up in My Bones.